Continuing my comments on Dr. Hui's ideas, the rewards of the American policy as compared with the terrorism of the bombing, the rewards consist in the great quantities of money in the form of food and other things which the United States has poured into South Vietnam. He said the people are grateful for all this, and he expects that aid from the United States and other countries will build up the country and modernize it once there is peace. So he has an opinion that certainly doesn't correspond with the views of most of the people at home who have the same general political philosophy, that is, a sort of reform liberalism. He believes the United States should have intervened even more aggressively, and he favors what the United States did in the way of terror bombing, and he believes the dislocation of society was a necessary means to defeat the communists. I wonder how many American liberals would agree with him if they had lived through the experience that he's been through. Still, I can't get it through my head how a government in the position of the United States in this country could work with private groups and ignore the government because the government is a corrupt government. This is just beyond my comprehension as a possible thing for the United States to have done. For private Americans to do some of this is, of course, feasible, and some things are being done. For the government to go in and, in effect, work against the local government, what kind of situation would that produce? This is Monday, January 22. This morning I had a long interview with Henry Bush at the USAID building. Bush seems to be in charge of land reform studies for Control Data Corporation. He gave me a copy of the latest study of land reform in South Vietnam. It'll be published in Washington later. The most interesting thing he had to say to me concerned the strange graph indicating actual effective land reform, that is, distribution of land to the landless. The graph shows some progress up to about 1960. Then, precisely during the 8 years of Presidents Kennedy and Johnson, no progress whatever. After that, under President Nixon, 69 to today, the most progress. Well, of course, I was very anxious to have his view as to why the graph has such a strange shape. And it amounts to this, what he had to say. That during the 60s, when money was being poured in for all sorts of aid, It was wasted on a great many cloud cuckoo land schemes, as he called them, such as a plan to develop a lot of turkey farms in South Vietnam. Another director of aid, or at least of the agricultural side of aid, he said, was a salesman of fertilizer. And the only thing he wanted to do was to sell fertilizer to the peasants. He wanted them to get a lot of fertilizer with the help of U.S. money, of course. And the fact that the rice land in South Vietnam, especially in the Mekong Delta, doesn't need any fertilizer. It's amazingly rich. Bush compared it to the soil of Iowa. This didn't matter to Mr. Salesman at all. The farmers had to have fertilizer, and so on. Then, according to Bush, there was a good deal of resistance among not only the landowners, but among the governmental leaders, starting with Diem during his later worst years, and going through the years of frequent coups, and into the early years of the Thieu government. But he said that President Nixon and President Thieu got together on the matter of land reform. Just how this worked wasn't clear to me. But Bush has studied the matter thoroughly, and I take it he means that even though it may have been happened through agents, they agreed that there should be genuine land reform. Now the program is going forward very fast. And farmers who were recently tenants or sharecroppers own up to 15 acres of rice land. They are becoming prosperous. Bush said that a great many of them are acquiring rototillers, the remarkable machines built by the Japanese for paddy land, designed so they won't sink in, such as our rototiller would on the island, won't sink into the muddy soil. Elizabeth and I have seen these machines in Japan. We thought they were the a side effect of the MacArthur land reform and the general economic prosperity of Japan. Now they are showing up, Japanese made, sold very vigorously by the Japanese, according to Bush. They're showing up in the Mekong Delta in considerable numbers. Bush said that many of the pretty young girls in white Ao Dai, school girls, that seems to be the standard uniform for girls of 16 or so. Many of these girls whom one observes on the streets in Saigon after school hours are actually the daughters of farmers who are able to send their daughters to Saigon to school. Bush said that in the Delta, school buses are taking children to school. They are going to school for the first time, and so on. Now, in detail, Bush says that in 1960, efforts at land reform had failed. The BC had decided to take over the Delta, which of course produced the vast majority of rice of Vietnam and made rice the great export crop of Vietnam. He says that the Bin Zion, that semi-political, semi-gangster outfit
controlled the Mekong River. He said that Johnson ignored land reform or thought it wasn't possible. Lodge and Company the same. He said that during that period, the American leaders thought that all we had on our side was that the elite classes in town, and they made no real effort to win over the farmers. So reform really got underway in 69. He spoke of a piece in a recent Center magazine, which talked about the way in which advice was given to the United States administration in the 60s in favor of land reform, and how the advice was given the brush off. Now, Bush admits that land reform has had little effect in central Vietnam. Tenancy is not a problem there. The landlords themselves are poor, own very little. It's in military districts 3 and 4, that is the Saigon Delta, Saigon River Delta, and the Mekong Delta, that land reform is really working nowadays. He said that part of the reason the tillers are coming in, those machines, is that the South Vietnamese government uses funds for to subsidize these imports. He said that Thieu himself has moved from a purely military policy to support of rural reform. And then he spoke of the importance of the miracle rice, the new seed, its great productivity, in accounting for the profitability of the paddy land, which formerly meant only poverty for the people who worked it. And he admits that some good was done during the non-reform periods, in the way of building roads and so forth. Actually, the problem under Johnson, he said, was to find things to spend the money on. And then he stressed that the Vietnamese people have drive. He said there is a cultural factor. They have drive, and given a chance, they really go to work. And that's what's happening in the Mekong Delta, now that the farmers are owning their land on a large scale. I asked him about corruption, naturally, and he admitted that there is corruption in the procedure of paying compensation. It works like this. The title to the tiller is free. The landlord gets up to $300 an acre when his land is expropriated. The corruption enters when this money, in filtering down from the central government to the landlord, is squeezed by the provincial and district politicians on the way to the landlord. They take their cut. But he said that a careful study indicates that only about 10% of the funds involved goes to corruption. Now, Bush contradicted what I have been hearing about the urbanization of the Vietnamese people. He admits that urbanism has grown. In fact, it has doubled from about 20% to 40% of the population. But still, the population is still 60% rural. And so he denies that this urbanization is important enough to provide the all-comprehensive explanation of the course of the war and so on that I've got from some other people. An important matter in explaining the new prosperity of the new land-owning farmers is that while all prices, for example, during a year running from 71 to 72, all prices went up 22%, the price of rice went up 55%. I was wrong a while back in saying that a non-landowner could acquire 5 acres, 15 acres. The fact is 5 acres. 15 acres is the maximum that a landowner can hold and keep from being appropriated. Since the early 20th century in particular, Bush says, extremely large-scale land ownership and absentee land ownership was the rule in the Delta. So the 15 acres is as a limit, is a big change. Well, I see here. It strikes me that in these ideas and figures given to me by Bush, based on the most thorough study available, one gets hold of a more solid foundation for understanding the crucial question of the peasantry than I've got from any other person or source so far. A point he made is that he never heard of Walt Rostow or other advisors influential during the 60s. He never heard of them having any serious interest in land reform. In the afternoon, I went out to Foster Parents Plan headquarters with Lars Borgström, the Swedish newspaperman from Göteborg. Miss Davison, the Canadian director, had the little girl whom Elizabeth and I have theoretically adopted, Mile, being two of her names, she has four. Mile and eight of her brothers and sisters and her mother and father brought up to her office, and we went out on the balcony for pictures, for greetings and pictures. Apart from the quite touching scene of these people all dressed up to meet the American. And Mile, who got over her fright and had a lovely smile, but not for for either of the cameras, I'm afraid. Apart from all that, the point that interested me most was that when Miss Davison, a very hearty type of person, very straightforward, took a look at this huge family, she turned to the Vietnamese girl, assistant of hers, who was holding the Mile's file, and quizzed her very sharply Has this woman been given birth control advice? Is she on the pill? And so forth. And it turned out that the woman has been on the pill, Mile's mother, but for some reason isn't at the moment. I didn't hear exactly why. And then another point that came out later in talking over Mile's family with Miss Davidson is the strange fact that although it's a Catholic family, the attitude toward marriage is not exactly orthodox in the Roman sense. The mother, Miss Davison thinks, is probably the second or third wife of the man. She says that's usual. She says divorce is not possible legally. A woman will get tired of a man, or vice versa. As a matter of fact, she put the emphasis on the man having the initiative. He will get rid of one wife and keep the children and take another wife. And sometimes he will have two or three wives all at the same time. A polygamous sort of situation carried on within the fold of the Roman Catholic Church. I thought it was a curiously ecumenical picture. This is January 24 at 3:15 in the afternoon. It's been quite an exciting day with news of the speeches by President Thieu and President Nixon announcing that a ceasefire will be signed on the 28th. I heard about it coming back from a visit to the Ministry of Rural Development, where I talked to three officials about the various rural programs and obtained a very strong impression of advances that have been made in recent years that we haven't heard about, comparable to those that Bush told me with respect to land reform. They told me that the farmers, however, are able to buy their tillers and otherwise raise capital by borrowing from, two or three agencies, including private banks that are subvented by the government, borrowing at the rate of 20%. I found that rather shocking. They said, however, that no mortgages are taken on the land, and there is no real penalty if a farmer neglects to pay up his monthly or annual payment on a short or long-term loan. He said later perhaps penalties will have to be installed, but at present it's working quite well, with the farmers paying up at the rate of an improving rate that has risen from the 70% range to the 80% range. Returning, we saw loudspeakers with crowds gathering near the cathedral and so on. And we got the news back at the council office. Then I went to lunch with Ambassador Bunker, and to my great delight, I was the only guest.
His wife, of course, is our minister to Nepal. So we were alone. And I must say it was an elegant house and an elegant meal. And not meaning to be repetitious, but only truthful, he's an elegant man. We talked about many light subjects. He said the London Economist and the Christian Science Monitor present the most balanced account and press reports of the war. And he's very accustomed to the imbalance of accounts everywhere, just about everywhere else. He spoke of the enormous number of Russian tanks that have been knocked out, not merely at Anlok, but far greater numbers up north. And other such things about which we've had little news in the United States. I told him that I thought it would be extremely important to get an oral history project underway here in Vietnam. I've met so many people who have important experience that they remember from as far back as the Second World War period, and indeed including himself. He explained that he's not kept a diary, and although publishers have asked him for his memoirs about his career as a diplomat since President Truman first appointed him ambassador to Argentina, he doesn't intend to write memoirs. He admitted that he has files, and he implied that he would be open to the possibility of making tapes for an oral history project. Incidentally, I mentioned this to Miss Lien when I came back, and she told me things I didn't know about particularly one person I met on the very first day, Captain Falk. She gave me some writings of his and explained that he is very concerned about historical materials, their preservation, and that he writes quite well himself. He has been educated in England, his brother Bick, and the brother who is the businessman in charge of the Mekong Industries conglomerate and head of the council. Educated in the United States. He said that the businessman would doubtless head up a new organization, but that people like Bick and Falk would really do the work. And we sketched out a scheme whereby trained oral historians in the United States would develop a staff here in Vietnam. Now I have to leave and go to the press conference, which may be interesting today for a change because of the great developments. Another thing the ambassador told me, before I forget, is that in 67 he advised Johnson to hit Laos hard and to break the Ho Chi Minh Trail. His advice wasn't taken. And the one clue that the ambassador gave to me as to his understanding why we failed in this country to the extent that we have is that bit by bit doesn't work. Slow escalation didn't work. This is the secret, according to Ambassador Bunker. He also said that he thinks that we have learned that we have to
hit hard in a situation like this. Nothing else will work. And he thinks next time, if there is another time, the United States will not try that step-by-step sort of escalation that has been a failure here. He said, naturally enough, that he thought that a ceasefire would work in spite of the leopard spots, that the leopard spots will be manageable.
Was hit by three rounds of 122-millimeter rocket fire. One civilian was killed, and six others were wounded. Well, as I become a captain in the Uber Group, what's your name?
Thưa quý vị, có nhiều lý do, ở trong đó cái lý do chính là từ sáng giờ chỉ có 3 người ghi tên để xin đi cái đó. Chúng tôi nghĩ rằng quý vị còn có nhiều việc khác để làm cho người này tham gia bay.
Well, there are several reasons, but the main reason is that because until this morning there were only two three cars.